This edition of The Entrepreneurs was first broadcast on the 11th of September 2013. The Entrepreneurs is brought to you in association with Pictet.
Hello and welcome to The Entrepreneurs, Monocle 24's weekly business show. I'm Sophie Grove. This week is the 100th episode of our humble show. Today we look at business longevity. To start the show, we head back to 1913 to visit two companies founded 100 years ago. First up, the classic American outerwear company, Scott NYC.
Everybody wanted to be the badass, to have that look, which really has been so relevant for 60 years. You know, it's still such an important look in fashion.
Then we'll stay in 1913. It's the 100th anniversary of Prada this year. We found out the secret of their century-long success in the fashion world.
Her shows are one of the most highly anticipated, not Absolutely. Just at Milan Fashion Week, but the entire, you know, Fashion Week calendar.
And we'll ask luxury impresario William Asprey how his family's businesses have attracted customers for over 200 years. That's seven generations and counting.
Quality and service, that's something we have always concentrated on, and I believe in this day and age it is still, you know, as important, if not more so, because there's probably more competition now than there was, you know, 75 years ago, 100 years ago.
We'll also talk business heritage with the CEO of 115-year-old Filson, catch up with a man behind Louis XIV's favourite candle maker, and discuss the Wilson Sporting Goods Company with our friends at Wink Creative. All that and much more coming up this week on a special 100th episode of The Entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 100 of The Entrepreneurs. I'm Sophie Grove. We start this special 100th episode with a trip back in time and with two successful brands in the United States and in Italy. First, we're in America. Founded in 1913, Scott NYC produces classic American outerwear. It's the brand that invented Perfecto, a name they still own today, which is one of the most popular styles of leather jacket, the one with the asymmetrical zipper. Though they work with many factories abroad, Scott's New Jersey operation is where all the leather work takes place. Monocle's Pauline Eiferman went there to find out how the brand has stayed relevant for a century.
The town of Union is only a short train ride from New York City. It's an unassuming New Jersey suburb where locals will often start the conversation in Spanish. And for a little over a year, it's been home to Schott's 75,000 square foot factory, which employs around 100 workers. Schott NYC started in 1913 as a small operation in the basement of a tenement building in Manhattan's Lower East Side. The sons of Russian immigrants, Irving and Jack Schott manufactured fur-lined raincoats that they sold door-to-door until they made enough to open up a shop.
It is very much a New York City brand, even though you're here in our factory in New Jersey, about 15 miles outside of New York. The beginnings all came from New York. Not only the brand was born there, but my great-grandfather was also born in New York.
That's Jason Schott, chief operating officer and fourth-generation family member. Sat in his simple office a few doors down from the busy factory, he explains building the brand was at first a humble process. But things changed when his great-grandfather became the first designer to use a zipper on outerwear, creating the brand's iconic motorcycle jacket. Commonly referred to as the Perfecto, it was adopted by riders first because the asymmetrical zip kept out the wind. Then Marlon Brando wore it in The Wild One.
Hey Johnny! Hey, get a load of this!
They're real bells! Aren't they cute?
Crazy!
Hey, somebody tell me what that means! BRMC! What does it mean?
Black Rebels Motorcycle Club!
Isn't that cute? Hey Johnny, what are you rebelling against?
What do you got?
By the 70s, the jacket was associated with some of music's biggest stars.
Everybody wanted to be the badass, to have that look, which really has been so relevant for 60 years. You know, it's still such an important look in fashion. And that was a big part of the growth as well. We do a lot. I mean, it's all facets of Americana, the police jackets, bomber flight jackets, pea coats and the motorcycle jackets, and other product categories in addition to jackets. But I think because of our association with the Perfecto, the asymmetrical motorcycle jacket, for so many years, yes, that's how we're best known. It seems to never go out of style. I mean, from Brando and James Dean to the Ramones and Bruce Springsteen in the 70s. And current rock stars and icons like Adam Levine and Jay-Z and Rihanna are all wearing that same jacket. It's just, we're very proud of it.
The motorcycle jacket consists of around 30 pieces of leather, each cut by hand one at a time. The classic model is made of cowhide, but some styles exist in lambskin, horsehide, or other versions of cow. John Francesco is one of the senior leather cutters in the factory. Armed with a small blade and a cardboard pattern, he skillfully slits the hide in pieces.
What's the jacket that you're working on right now?
This is a little motorcycle jacket.
And you do everything by hand?
Everything by hand. Everything by hand. One by one. Yes.
How long have you worked here for?
No, I don't know. You don't want to know, right? 43 years. I started in 1972. You didn't even born that time.
After being cut, the leather travels to 5 different areas of the factory and is assembled at the end. About 30 different people will touch the jacket as it's being created. According to Jason, despite the constant growth of employees, not much has changed in the production process since the brand's beginnings. Some machines, for example, are a century old. Because of that, the company has a full-time mechanic on staff. It's a testament to the new generation's attachment to the brand's heritage.
Our focus has always been on the factory first. My family, my great-grandfather was always in the factory. My grandfather was always happiest tinkering with machines, and he, in fact, created a couple of proprietary machines. That was always his favorite part, was working on the actual machines. My mother is in the factory right now as we speak, inspecting every jacket that comes off the floor.
Jason's mother is the company's president and his uncle is the CEO. He plans to hand down management to his children someday, but only when they're ready.
It's incredibly important to me to keep it a family business. I mean, it's my family was always the toughest bunch of employers I ever had, but they taught me a lot of valuable lessons. I have not always worked here. We always try to get any family members interested in joining to go get some experience working somewhere else to learn other areas of business and bring it into the company, and also to learn what it's like to work for other people. And it gets a little bit challenging sometimes. We seem to do a good job as a family of separating business and family. So there are times where we don't always agree, and we'll have some heated days where we're battling back and forth on something. And it seems to be pretty easy. We transition pretty quickly from that to a family dinner where we're all together and none of that stuff comes up. So I think everybody has their own role. It's a big enough company that we each have our own area of expertise. And so it works out very well. And the best part is there's a trust factor with everyone.
That trust is one of the secrets to Schott's long-lasting success, he says. But the attachment to family and heritage influences much more than the company's strategy, as design director Charles Edmondson explains.
I'm going to show you in this last year's catalog a jacket that we did. We always base what we're doing next year on last year's success. That makes sense, right? This liner jacket here, which is nylon on the outside and Hudson Bay lining in the inside, did very well for us. So they want next year's version of that.
Jason's mother often says that history is the future. And that's a philosophy that really rings true for the brand. In a month, they will open the first Schott store in the country since the 1940s. Unsurprisingly, it's located less than a mile from the original shop, born nearly a century ago. For Monocle, in Union, New Jersey. I'm Polly Neiferman.
You're listening to The Entrepreneurs. Now, another business founded in 1913 is luxury icon Prada. Starting out as a Milanese workshop owned by brothers Mario and Martino, Prada is one of the fashion success stories of the 20th and 21st centuries. This is largely due to the arrival of the brothers' granddaughter, Mercia, who took the helm in 1970 and inherited the business in 1978. It's then things got very interesting. Mercia started producing her own lines of bags using the tough military spec black nylon her grandfathers had used to cover steamer trunks. A few years later, she launched the Prada handbag. It was an instant hit, and a shoe line and ready-to-wear collection followed. The business blossomed, and so did Prada's holdings. It's an icon of the 1990s that's innovated and adapted to meet the demands of the modern consumer. Monocle's design editor Tom Morris sat down at Midori House with Anna Santi, deputy editor of Draper's magazine, to find out how.
It started 100 years ago by Mucia Prada's great-grandfather.
Right.
And Mucia is now the creative director and runs it. And it used to be sort of a travel brand.
Mm-hmm.
They used to supply the Italian royal family at the time as well, but it's very exclusive.
That's how old it is.
Yeah, exactly. And it sort of plodded along doing that, really. And then, as you say, it was when Mucia took over, I think in 78, 79, that she really changed the brand around to what it is today. And it was with Patrizio Bertelli, who's the chief executive and now her husband. So it shows how important having the right people behind a brand is. In fact, I would say that their partnership was the turning point in the evolution of Prada and into the brand that it is it is today.
When did it become fashion? When did they introduce clothes to the collection?
They introduced it quite early on. Yeah. So like I said, she took over in about 78, 79, I can't remember. And then from the 80s onwards, first of all, she introduced footwear and then she introduced clothing. And I think it was around 1986 that she introduced clothing to the brand. So as you say, it's quite new in a way, given the 100-year history.
Yeah.
It's only in the last 20 to 30 years that these new elements have been introduced. She did start off when she took over, she developed these nylon backpacks, and that was her
famous one.
Exactly. And that was her sort of trademark. And what was quite interesting there was that she used these tiny little silver triangles as logos, essentially. And that's been a real differentiator, I think, for Prada and other luxury brands, that they haven't been as logo heavy as, say, the Louis Vuittons. So that's what she did. And from then on, that feel of exclusivity continued throughout the brand right until now, its current incarnation.
And it's very Prada's very interesting in the fact that it does have, in the fashion industry and beyond, it's the intellectual brand, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And that's kind of part and parcel with Mucia's personality.
Yes.
Was she a communist?
Yeah. What I heard was that she never wanted to get into fashion in the first place. And then, she was very political in her youth and her early years. But then she obviously decided that she could do something good in fashion, and she has. She's an individual. You know, she has said, I always want to be the first to do everything.
Yeah.
And I think she stayed true to those values.
Yeah.
And you look at what she does each season, you know, her shows are one of the most highly anticipated, just at Milan Fashion Week, but the entire, you know, Fashion Week calendar.
So what's her husband's involvement in it? I mean, he's the sort of the business brains, isn't he?
He is. So he's the chief executive. And like I was saying, I think the fact that the business turned around, not turned around, but it was a turning point when she joined and he joined, is really crucial, because he brings the business acumen, the commercialism to the brand. And that allows her to stay very, very creative. And I think that's key. And you look at other brands where that has happened, and you can see how it's a really important ingredient. I mean, I know a gentleman called David Jones. He's a luxury consultant, and he has taught various designers, including Matthew Williamson and Joseph Velosa.
Right,
and there's a really funny anecdote, because he said to me that Matthew would only turn up to his classes when he felt like it, whereas Joseph was always there.
Yeah.
And you look at that
you
relationship,
need that, don't you,
you know, Joseph drives the business, Matthew drives the design. And And I think that's what you have with Mucci and Patrizio. It works very, very well. And fashion is such a, at that level, such a creative industry.
Absolutely.
You know, at luxury, you have to be so different and you have to innovate that the person responsible for that product and design innovation needs to be allowed to do that. So Patrizio brings in that business element.
And it's also, you know, for a husband and wife team and, you know, a family business, it's a very sort of admirable model. But I mean, there is the Prada Group now. Can you just talk a little bit more about, you know, outside of the Prada brand, what sort of a multi-million pound, massive, massive business it's become?
It has. They obviously have Miu Miu as well. Yeah. That's their younger sub-brand.
Yeah.
That was named after Mucci. That's her nickname. they launched that in 93, wow. I think it was. Yeah. And they've got Church's as well. English shoemakers. They've got Car Shoe. Yeah, that's the other one.
Yeah.
What was interesting about Prada's history was in the early 2000s. Mm. So that's when Patrizio started to acquire lots of labels and take shares in brands. So the Gucci Group, Jill Sander, Fendi, all that happened in that period.
Oh, right.
But it wasn't actually very successful. And then by the end of that decade, they started to sell those businesses off again.
Right.
And the problem that they've had ever since actually was the amount of debt that they were left with.
Really?
Yeah. So I remember back in 2009, they were speaking to their banks to renegotiate some of their terms so that they could ease some of that debt pressure and be able to expand into bricks and mortars internationally.
Right.
You look at the history of Prada and it seems quite flawless.
Yeah.
But actually that period was a bit fraught for them, and you know, they really have learned from it and have, you know, had to adapt the business as a result.
And they've always been quite careful. I mean, you just look at their sort of retail expansion, it's nowhere near as aggressive as Louis Vuitton or Burberry or someone like that. But yet, you know, they have this sort of international reputation and presence. Has that been a deliberate thing or just as a result of that?
I think it's been a deliberate thing because it's in line with how Mucci treats the product development in that she does keep it exclusive. So, you know, they do limited collections, they do flash sales. So I think the growth in terms of store portfolio has been deliberate.
Yeah.
And you're right. I think they have half as many stores as Louis Vuitton. I think they have a third of the number of stores that Burberry has in Hong Kong.
Wow.
So this is Hong Kong and Asia specifically. So you can see that it's a big difference. And I think that's a brilliant strategy. I was recently talking to a consultant at Bain & Company and he was saying to me that there are too many luxury brands that have overexpanded in Asia, and actually they're finding that their store performances are flat at best. And I think we'll see some luxury brands closing some of those shops. Because the thing with luxury brands is that you also need to retain that level of exclusivity. So if you've got a shop, three shops on every street, you know, a shop around every corner, then it becomes too saturated. So I think Prada's strategy has on that front has been very, very well.
Off.
Yeah, definitely.
And sort of talking about the product, what makes Prada Prada? I mean, we were sort of talking earlier about, you know, this intellectualness of Prada, and you sort of, you know, the Prada woman is a very specific type of woman. Mm. Same with Miu Miu. How is that so important to the brand?
I think it's really important. What Mucci does is that she surprises everybody. Okay, not every single season, but pretty much every season she does do that. For example, in autumn 2008, she sent pretty much every model head to toe in lace down her catwalk show in Milan.
I remember that.
And it made everybody look okay, and it wasn't all kind of girly and frou-frou. It had an edge to it, but you weren't expecting that. And it was, you know, the head to toe-ness of it as well. It wasn't as a trim or anything like
that. I remember her saying in an interview that she only did lace, she doesn't like lace, but she did it because it was a test for her to sort of, you know, use a material that she doesn't like very much.
Yeah, exactly. I think she said, I'll use it as a detail. And she said, no, I'm not going to use it as a detail. I'm going to go, you know, full on with it. And I think it worked because it got everyone talking about it. And then beyond that, the way it filtered to the high street. Actually, that year, we put Mucci Prada in the Draper's top 100 list of most influential fashion people because of that, because of the effect it had on the rest of the high street. You'd walk into any retailer, whether it was New Look or M&S, and they had lace.
Yeah.
And they still do.
Yeah. And Kate Middleton, X amount of years later, got married in it.
Exactly. So, you know, that's a huge impact. And this season, spring 13, everyone's wearing flat forms. I think they're horrible, but they're all over the high street, and she did them in her show.
Yeah.
So you see the power that she has to shock, yeah, to innovate, and I think that's really important.
Yeah. And for, I mean, Mucci is just so much part and parcel of the brand. Mm. Celebrating its 100-year anniversary, what next? What happens when she decides to retire?
Well, I think what next for the brand is interesting, but actually particularly from an online perspective, in that she is very anti-digital. You know, she, yeah, there's a brilliant quote from her in Women's Wear Daily where she said, "Personally, I don't like it. We don't like it. I'm not interested." And she's, yeah, very, very against it. She says it's not in line with the luxury environment to sell your clothes online. Admittedly, you can actually buy the accessories online.
Okay.
It's just the clothes. So I don't quite understand why it's okay for shoes and bags, but not for clothes.
They probably make more money.
Yeah. So she is very against that. Mm. And on the one hand, I admire her because if she believes that's the right strategy, she's obviously executing it and adhering to that belief.
Absolutely.
And you look at someone like Burberry, who, yep, has done brilliantly from its digital strategy. But what Burberry has done is weaved it into its brand values. I think when you look at Burberry now, it's not just that you can buy, they're not just sales channels. It's part of the brand DNA.
Yep.
And it's not that for Prada, and in fact it's not like that for really any other luxury brand. But my concern is that, you know, you don't know what the horizon is going to look like in 5, 10, 20 years time, and I worry that the next generation of genuine Prada customers who admire what she has done, that really buy into the aesthetic, into the service, into everything that goes into it, will want to buy online just because that's how the world
is.
Exactly. So I think that would be really interesting to see how that develops, and she will have to find a way of not accepting it, but finding a Prada way,
yeah,
of evolving, yeah, the brand.
That was Anna Santi, deputy editor of Draper's magazine, with Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, talking about Prada, founded 100 years ago this year. After the break, we'll revisit three brands that have withstood the very long test of time. Stay tuned.
An expert opinion is invaluable when considering future investments. Caroline Rail, senior investment manager at Pictet, highlights the luxury sector as an emerging market, driven by Chinese consumers.
Roughly 15% of the luxury sector is being bought today by a Chinese consumer. The interesting thing is that Chinese consumers tend to buy luxury products when they travel, which is a good thing because they tend to spend a lot of money when traveling, much more than the traditional tourist, Japanese, American, or European.
To hear other expert opinions on emerging markets, trends, and foreign investment, visit perspectives.pictet.com.
There's a touch of gold rush optimism on Fogo Island, the remote outpost off the coast of Newfoundland. Monocle Films journeyed to this idyll lost in time to witness reinvention at work.
Just living in that tangle with the North Atlantic breeds a kind of acute awareness of the natural, and I think it just makes you kind of quick, and quick to a solution, quick to a response. And so that, I mean, you could call that entrepreneurial, but the ingenuity is all here. So really what we hope to do with our projects is just to kind of be the electric eel in the pond that helps with the connections.
Microloans meet macro ambitions on Fogo Island in the film section of Monocle.com.
Welcome back to The Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove. The sad fact is that most businesses fail. The vast majority of new startup companies will never make it to their first birthday party, and those which do succeed rarely last for decades, let alone centuries. This week, we revisit three brands featured on The Entrepreneurs during the last 100 episodes that have withstood this tough test of time, either through ingenuity, cleverness, or sheer strength of will. We begin with William Asprey, who was first featured on episode 36. William is the chairman of William & Son, a premium luxury brand found on London's Mount Street. He's also the seventh generation of the Asprey family to sell high-quality luxury goods, the Aspreys having specialised in luxury for over 200 years. Monocle's Daphne Denis visited William in his store to find out how one family can achieve two centuries of business success and how the lessons of the past can inform his future decisions.
Well, I first worked in the family business probably at the age of 15, and I started off as a porter and a packer. So that was everything from delivering parcels to customers, emptying the dustbins and opening doors. Being part of a family which has a heritage of over 200 years in luxury retail sometimes makes it very easy to decide what you're going to do because you're brought up with it. It's not in a way something that you need to be trained for, because you grow up with the business, you grow up within a family which is always talking about the business and living the business. So from that point of view, one could say that you don't need to actually go out and study luxury world, because you sort of absorb it through osmosis. On the other hand, there are pressures put on you that perhaps make you think that that is the only thing you can do, and that you have to follow into the family business, and there are no other choices. I was very fortunate that I had two younger brothers who had as many choices as I did about what they wanted to do. And I was just fortunate, I suppose, in a point of view that I enjoyed the luxury world. But I do think it's important that in any business that you go into where there is a family heritage and history, that you can't just walk in at the top and assume that, one, you're going to know what to do, you're going to know how the business works, and that you're going to be successful. Because none of that is ever, you know, guaranteed.
And I guess you also had to find your place, your niche, your own thing that you wanted to do within the luxury world, didn't you?
Yes, although to begin with, obviously, that wasn't really necessarily my choice. Because when I started full-time in a business, you know, I was moved around different areas of the business, you know, started off in the accounts department. So, you know, I was very much sent on a sort of learning curve. And I also went to Switzerland for 3 months to do a course in the management of a luxury goods business. So there are always things that can be learned. And certainly, you know, people who've been off and done, you know, business degrees, people who have, you know, been to INSEAD and various other, you know, high-powered business schools find it very beneficial. But you have to want to do that.
You were mentioning how from the start, when you were 15, you were moving parcels and doing all sorts of different types of work that you wouldn't necessarily think of a job that you would do as the son of someone who was already the head of a big brand. Do you think it's important to learn from the bottom up?
Yes, I do, because I think that way you can relate to everybody within the business. And you can say to the chap who's meant to be opening the door or wrapping a parcel, you can, you know, perhaps say, look, I think you could do it better. And he will know that you have perhaps been in his position. So I think it is important that, you know, you have an understanding and understand perhaps how their day can pan out, and whether it's a good day or a bad day. And also, you know, it teaches you tolerance, because you know what they have to go through. And yes, everybody looks at the world differently and, you know, has different experiences. So the more experience you can have within a business, the better. Although sometimes it's good to go outside your business, then you can bring other experiences back with you.
Has your family's legacy informed the way that you treat your current business, Williams & Son?
Yes, it has, because certainly with quality and service, that's something we have always concentrated on, and I believe in this day and age it is still, you know, as important, if not more so, because there's probably more competition now than there was, you know, 75 years ago, 100 years ago. And why would a customer come to us rather than go somewhere else? And I think a lot of that comes down to the service that they receive and the personal relationship that you build with the customer.
What kind of advice would you give to people who want to build a luxury brand today in this day and age, and who don't necessarily come from a family that has done that forever?
Well, I think the principles in a way are the same in every business, in that you have to be passionate about what you do, you have to enjoy it, and you have to have a belief in yourself and in the product and what you're creating, whether it's a restaurant, whether it's a casino in Leicester Square, or if it's a luxury goods business. I think in any job and any business that you want to start, you've got to really want to do it. We spend more time at work than we do at home, so you've got to make sure you enjoy what you're doing.
And do you enjoy what you're doing then?
Yes, I do. I'm extremely lucky. We meet very different people every day. And it can be an Algerian bottle washer who wants a passport cover because he's just received his British citizenship to, you know, preparing a gift for Her Majesty the Queen.
That was William Asprey of William & Son with Monocle's Daphne Denis. Now on to Filson, the classic 115-year-old American heritage brand from the Pacific Northwest. Filson, founded by a former railroad conductor and Nebraska homesteader, first supplied gold-hungry prospectors with the best outdoor gear they could find. They now manufacture durable and handsome handmade bags and apparel out of Seattle. The entrepreneurs met with Filson CEO Alan Kirk in episode 81, when the company opened its first outpost outside the United States, right here in London. We caught up with him again this week to find out the secrets of the company's growth over a century.
Filson is a 116-year-old company that was originally founded in Seattle, Washington. C.C. Filson outfitted pioneers that were heading into the second gold rush to find gold into cold, cold, extreme conditions. And he continued to perfect the clothing, build the clothing built on customers' feedback. And through the years, the company's never really steered away from its original DNA. It's actually been very slow to change in some cases, but always perfecting that high quality, built to last, functional clothing. Core fabrics have been used for many, many years that were protective. And I think that's really been one of the key successes over 100 plus years, where the company's stayed true to its DNA.
And heritage, how important really is heritage? As you were saying, DNA is extremely important, but adaptation is surely necessary. I mean, for a company that's over 100 years old, you have to go with the times. How do you balance that adaptation with the staying with the core brand?
The adaptation of the brand today is really done through a number of things. One is material choice, where today our customers looking for a Filson product that's, again, high quality, built to last, functional, but perhaps with slightly lighter fabrics, or breathable technology in fabrics. Or another idea we've brought in is layering. You know, rather than having heavy wool and tin cloth, we've introduced layering, where you've got a lighter weight shell that's great mobility and functionality, and then you have layering pieces that work with the outer piece. So looking at technology, looking at fabrics, and trying to build product that meets the needs of today's wearer. Another example, in our fishing line, we do a fishing line which is, for instance, wading. We're bringing in highly technical wading jackets that are waterproof, have movement, and are breathable, lightweight. So that's an example how we feel we're adapting to the times, but still staying true to our DNA.
Is it important to find a perfect home for the company? Filson's been in Seattle since the beginning. How important is location?
Oh, location is very important to us. It was founded in Seattle in 1897. We're still in Seattle, you know, less than a mile from the original building. And we'll stay here. We've recently expanded our supply chain, which we feel is extremely important to the success of the brand, making more product at Filson. We plan to make over 90% of our product within the Filson supply chain in Seattle. And that's going to be our home for hopefully the next 100 years plus.
And for those budding entrepreneurs and new brands out there who hope to last as long as you guys, I mean, what are some tips you might have for them who are listening?
Well, I think the tips that I would pass along, one is really understand your brand, know your DNA, and don't deviate from it. And then secondly, really understand your customer, know who your customer is and look after your customer, and have some key guiding principles. We've believed in high quality and never ever compromising. We believe that made in the US is something that's important to us, and we won't compromise. And again, staying true to your DNA.
That was Alan Kirk, CEO of American heritage brand Filson, with our producer Daniel. And make sure you tune in to episode 81 in our online Time Shift to learn how and why the company decided to set up shop in London. Our final retrospective brand is the oldest, French candle-making extraordinaire Ciré Trudon. Ciré was first featured on episode 70 of The Entrepreneurs, when our producer Daniel visited the factory in Normandy.
Today's interesting because you see private label, so Fragonard, big French perfume brand based in Grasse. An interesting brand because they use a ceramic container that's made in France, in Limoges. Very good brand. And on the other side, you see our home brand, Ciré Trudon. And actually, this is one of our limited editions and a collaboration project where we have put together for Martell, the cognacs. Another interesting company because they are maybe the only company in the world that used to purvey to the court of France and are still manufacturing the exact same product they used to manufacture them. We used to purvey to the court of Versailles. There are two methods to make candles. One is, we could call it a semi-automatic method. The candles run through this section of the machine where the wicks are centered and glued in the bottom of each container. And then they're filled either through that machine over there, which has about a dozen nozzles on it and will fill a line of candles each time. Or they're later filled on these tables using almost 100% manual process by lines of 4, 5, or 6 using those machines you see at the other end. Those are the metal bases of the wicks that allow to clamp the wick at the base and to be glued at the bottom of the jar. And all that is done automatically through this machine. The jar run through this section and come out with the wick centered and cut at the proper length out of this machine.
Where do you get such a machine like this?
There are a few candle manufacturing machine makers in the world. The best are based in Germany. There are a couple in Italy as well. So this is a specific machine designed for candle manufacturing. And as our know-how evolves, we have either adapted machines or have requested our manufacturers to adapt machines for us. This machine will soon be replaced. This is probably a special order for one of our customers in our store in Paris that requested a specific jar color for 2 large candles. It's a lot of wax. That's 3 kilograms of wax and 5 wicks. So you can imagine the time you will need to go through this. A couple hundred hours, actually. So this is where we keep our stock of various waxes. They all come in solid form. So prior to production, they're all weighed to the gram. Natural waxes all come in flakes. When it comes to paraffin waxes, some are come in flakes or in large pieces. I'll show you, open this bag for you. We also keep our wicks here on these large spools. So that's only part of the collection. We have quite a collection of various wick references.
And who makes these?
Candle wick manufacturers. There is such an industry. There may be 2 or 3 people in the world that make them on an industrial scale. It's very specific and highly technical. They're all 100% cotton and all coated with wax. In this secured area where we keep our home fragrances and our clients' fragrances. So you'll recognize a few of these, some names here, and including ours.
Overwhelming smell of...
Nice. A blend nice. Of all kinds of fragrances. I don't know if this blend is nice, but it is, as you say, overwhelming.
The company was founded in Paris by ex-grocer Claude Trudon in 1643, and then went on to be the official provider to the court of Louis XIV and Napoleon. We met the company's executive director, Julien Prouveau, to see how they've managed to have a longer history than most countries.
Julian, we spoke first when I visited your beautiful factory in Normandy, and now we're looking at companies that have managed to last quite a long time, and you're by far the oldest company we've had on the show. What do you attribute that to? How have you lasted so long?
I think it's two things. One, we're still manufacturing the same thing. We were manufacturing centuries ago, candles. Now we've just adapted the product through time. And what we propose today is still a candle, but it's entirely different from what was produced back then.
And I suppose it's kind of important to go with the flow and adapt. You first made candles for royalty, Louis XIV, and then for Napoleon, and now you make candles for everyone, really, scent-loving individuals, companies, stores. Is adaptation an important part at all?
Yes, we had to adapt not only the product, but also the people to whom we sell. Now, our main markets are for our home brands, our retail stores, obviously, and for private label companies of all sizes, and for our classic tabletop products such as taper candles and the rest, that can be hotel, restaurants, and events.
And how have you kept kind of a continuous flow of the brand identity, of traditions, of heritage throughout the hundreds of years the company's been around?
If you're thinking about Cyr Trudon, it hasn't always been maintained as it is today. It was revived only during the early 2000s. And before that, the company was really focusing on its manufacturing aspect and not too much on the brand aspect of the company. So that was revived fairly recently compared to the scale we're talking about.
For kind of budding entrepreneurs, new brands out there wanting to, looking at Cyr Trudon and wanting to last as long as you guys have, any words of wisdom, any lessons you've learned, any challenges you've overcome that you think would be interesting to know?
I mean, dealing with Cyr Trudon is quite particular. I mean, it's such a gem, it's been around for so long that it's very careful steering. So if you are lucky enough to be part or own a company with such incredible history, focusing on that history and on the DNA of the company and making sure you're not steering brutally away from it, and you're adapting the best product that has been made since the early days of the company, that's when you meet with success. Usually is when you use the know-how and you combine it with the history to make an even better product adapted to present times. I believe that's the best method. At least that's how it was conducted for Cyr Trudon.
That was Julian Prouveau, Executive Director of Cyr Trudon Candlemakers in France. We'll be back with our weekly branding chat right after this short break.
Despite its decline in value against other economies since 2001, the US dollar continues to influence global trade. As Yves Bonzon, Pictet's Chief Investment Officer, explains.
In a dollar depreciation regime, typically all assets that benefit from cheap dollar financing tend to perform well. So in the last 10 years, since 2001, we had strong performance from emerging market equities, emerging market debt, gold and commodities.
To hear other expert views on emerging markets, trends and foreign investment, visit perspectives.pictet.com.
Time now for our weekly branding chat with our colleagues at Wink Creative. This week we doubled down on the longevity theme. We dug deep into the archives and found another fantastic company founded a century ago, in 1913, one that's still growing and thriving. Wink Creative's R.C. Hooverinen and Erica Dawn sat down with our producer Daniel to chat about the Wilson Sporting Goods Company.
Well, we thought it would be an interesting brand to talk about since it was founded in 1913, which was obviously 100 years ago. And we think that it has some interesting elements that we find could use a bit of brushing up in terms of how they communicate their brand and so forth.
So let's talk about their history. They obviously were founded in 1913. Where have they been since then?
Yes, they were founded in 1913 by Thomas E. Wilson. I think an interesting element to mention there was that they were actually originally founded to find ways of using slaughterhouse byproducts. such as tennis racket strings and violin strings. And they kind of just then slowly started developing into actual products themselves. So they started producing tennis rackets and baseball shoes quite shortly after.
And at the moment, so they were founded in Chicago, but they're actually owned by a Finnish company now, right?
Right, that's correct. Owned by Amer Sports, as the Finnish pronounce it, which is actually the largest holding company, which is affiliated with sporting goods products nowadays.
So Erica, so let's talk about the branding now. What kind of branding does Wilson have?
They have a really iconic logo. And, you know, it's one of the things that's really great about their brand. It's a logo that feels like it's been around. It's a lot of new brands these days, very young brands who try to create logos that emulate that to kind of fake the history and heritage. And they actually have that, which is great. I think the problem is not their visual identity itself, but what they are able to attach to it. And that includes the way they communicate and engage with people, which we think is actually very limited at the moment. Even if you look on their website, there's very little there about their brand history, the story of how they started, which is actually really interesting. There's nothing about that on there. Their lack of flagship stores and just general presence really is lacking, I think.
It seems like there's the brand itself is faceless and there's no like emotional element to it, whereas with Nike, you can easily tie it to Phil Knight. I mean, simply put, it's just lacking this emotional element that people can kind of relate to in a way. So there's no brand story, in essence.
And I find this funny because I don't know if you've both seen Castaway with Tom Hanks, and you say it's faceless and he draws the face on the Wilson ball.
Right, that's right.
Do you know if they play that up at all or not? I mean, I haven't seen anything about them taking advantage of that.
See, that's the thing. We couldn't find anything that they would have. I mean, probably around the time when Castaway came out, I would be surprised if they didn't do something then. But I mean, that was huge. I mean, it was such an I wouldn't go as far as calling it iconic, but something that not many brands have had the opportunity to kind of harness.
They are very quiet generally. I mean, it's their 100th anniversary, and we haven't seen or heard, you know, anything about that. We didn't even know, you know, that it was that old. So I think they're really missing a trick in not communicating that.
There's nothing on the website mentioning that they turn 100 this year. So,
and you had said that they never actually have crossed over into this lifestyle fashion kind of brand, like maybe some of their competitors, Nike and Adidas.
It's fascinating. I mean, a huge part of the revenue that comes to these companies like Nike and Adidas, as you mentioned, comes from the lifestyle brand, and it's something that's you know been marketed very well and very very efficiently by these competing brands. But they always just stuck to their own thing, and they just always produced like really straight up sporting goods, and never really made the jump to that side, which I think is really interesting.
Let's talk about some maybe these innovations that these companies that we just spoke about have had, like Nike and Adidas. You know, Nike has Air Max. They don't have, Wilson doesn't really have any of this, do they?
Well, they do, but
or it's not promoted.
Well, maybe it's promoted in very kind of niche circles. So it's, you know, just professional tennis players or golf players who would know about these things. They're not sort of marketed to the public. I mean, you're average kid on the street is not going to go out and buy a sandwich club R90 because it's very, very specific. And I think it's kind of great that they've stayed with this kind of purist idea that it's about actually improving the product and not about, you know, selling it to, you know, in a sort of street style kind of way or anything like that. The innovations happen, I think, and especially during like the 30s and 40s, they did such a good job at sort of improving their product in manufacturing that they didn't just survive the Great Depression, they sort of prospered during it, which is, you know, great, but we just don't really hear about it because we're not professional golf players.
Right.
So if you guys were just handed the Wilson account right now, Erica, as a designer, you said you love the logo, you wouldn't do anything about it, right?
I mean, maybe there's a small tweak in there, but generally it's a very strong logo, and I think it's just about, you know, attaching an emotional element to it, getting it out there, you know, getting it associated with certain players and certain people in order to make a connection.
Sure. And Arcee, what about you?
I think first and foremost, I'd go with just actually just creating a brand story for Wilson. I mean, it doesn't even need creating. It's there.
Play up the slaughterhouse idea.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of brands try to, you know, make these up.
That's right, yeah.
And they don't have to.
So just basically communicating what they actually already have, because it seems just like a very passive way of doing what they do.
That was Arsi Hoverinen and Erica Dawn of Wink Creative with our producer Daniel on the Wilson Sporting Goods Company, which celebrates its centennial anniversary this year. This show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, our studio manager is Holly Fisher, and I'm Sophie Grove. Please feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or feedback, and you can reach me at sgr@monocle.com and our producer Daniel at dg@monocle.com. Taking Us Out Now is a bit of entrepreneurial inspiration. Here's Taking Care of Business by Bachman Turner Overdrive. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for more inspiring news and views from entrepreneurs around the world.